Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening. Charles Lamb is considered one of the finest essayists in the English language. He's remembered as a member of the romantic circle of poets that included Samuel Taylor Coleridge and William Wordsworth. But if you're not an English lit major, chances are you know him best for a book which was first published in 1807 and is still in print, Tales from Shakespeare. These are retellings of Shakespeare's plays for young readers, and it's a book that Lamb wrote with his sister, Mary. It is safe to say, though, that most of the people who know that book and have read it are unaware that 10 years before it was written, Mary Lamb stabbed her mother to death with a carving knife. The story of that murder and of the relationship between Charles and Mary Lamb is told in a new book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of the book is Mad Mary Lamb, Lunacy and Murder in Literary London, and it's published by W.W. Norton by our guest, Susan Tyler Hitchcock. She's someone who has worked in publishing throughout much of her career. She began as an editorial assistant at Harper & Row back in the early 70s and currently is a contract book editor for the National Geographic Society. She's written for newspapers, magazines, and essay anthologies. She has also written a number of books, including Geography of Religion, Where God Lives, Where Pilgrims Walk, and Coming About, A Family Passage at Sea. And, of course, the new one that's out now and is in bookstores if you're interested in reading it. As we talk this morning, too, questions are welcome. All you have to do to be a part of the conversation is pick up the telephone and call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So people can join the conversation. The only thing that we ask of callers is that they're brief, just so that we can accommodate as many as possible and keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call in. Also, by the way, if you're interested in reading more about her and her work, she does also have a website that you can check out, which is SusanTylerHitchcock.com. Ms. Hitchcock, hello.
Hello there.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Before getting into the story, it might be good to talk a little bit about the received view, or what probably would have been the commonly held view about the Lambs. For people who just sort of have a casual knowledge of them. And apparently what happened during the time that they were alive, the story of the murder was kept very closely within their circle. And
yes,
it was not until after she died did it become well known what had happened. And that, apparently that, ever after, at least until now, colored the way people thought about them, and particularly about him.
About Charles.
About
yes,
Charles.
Indeed. Yeah, well, they would have been absolute unknowns at the time of the matricide, which was 1796. They were the children in a serving class family. Within the next, say, 20 to 25 years, they would have gained some fame, really, especially among London readers, not only for their associations with the more famous poets like Coleridge and Wordsworth, but also for Charles's work as an essayist. He tried early on as a reporter, a newspaper reporter, but he just couldn't get the once-a-day habit. But he ended up being a very popular essayist with a wry sense of humor, so that in the 1820s he actually was very well known for his Essays of Elia, E-L-I-A, which was his pseudonym. And that means that at his death in the 1830s, he was greatly mourned. His sister, though, would not have been known except as a character in those essays. Actually, he calls her Bridget Elia in those essays. And also, well, she, to tell you the truth, she wouldn't have even been known as a co-author of the children's books that they wrote, because her name was not put on the title page when Tales from Shakespeare was published. So it's only after her death in 1847 that the literary journals begin to seep out the secret. Biographies had already been written, actually, of Charles Lamb, keeping it a secret. But in 1847, an anonymous review came out saying that Charles was such a great writer and would have been even better had it not been for the horrible thing that happened, the secret that the family had kept all these years in 1796, that is, that his older sister had killed their mother and had lived the life of a lunatic for the rest of her life, being cared for by her brother. From that point on, certainly among the Victorians, Charles Lamb was called Saint Charles, and even Virginia Woolf in A Room of One's Own refers to him that way, perhaps slightly ironically, but she's still passing on the legacy. Mm-hmm. And that comes up to the present day. I mean, I studied English literature all the way through college and graduate school, and you know, I met Mary Lamb in footnotes. There would be footnotes to the famous poem Charles is known for, probably the one that comes into anthologies the most commonly, The Old Familiar Faces. And each of that's a short poem with stanzas about all the people that he has no longer in his life. For one reason or another, they have gone. They've all gone, the old familiar faces. And one of those faces is his sister. Go down to the footnote, and you learn that she had killed their mother and was crazy, and he took care of her all his life. That really is the story that has been told. Very little of an insight into Mary's side of the story, and that's why I thought a book needed to be written.
Yeah. Well, it seems that you're interested in correcting the record in many respects, and this impression, as you say, that Charles was some kind of a saint and that he sacrificed his life could have been greater had he not given over so much of his energy to taking care of his unstable sister. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's not really the way that it was. And the picture that you paint of them, particularly of their later life together, because they did indeed live together, neither of them married. They lived together for almost 40 years. This was in very many ways, a partnership where they cared in each in their own way for each other, and that certainly she was not some sort of lifelong unstable invalid that needed constant monitoring so that she didn't get into trouble.
Yeah, actually what I found looking closely was that, quite honestly, Charles was about as unstable as she was. He managed his bouts of insanity or mental illness in various ways. He did dive into depressions and writes about that in his letters. He also had manic episodes where he wrote just fast and furiously to get one thing or another finished. He actually was clearly an alcoholic, and there are many letters from Mary to friends of hers and friends of theirs talking about how she's trying to keep Charles from drinking so much and smoking so much tobacco. And, you know, one has the sense there are many ways in which she provided the household that allowed Charles Lamb to become the writer that he was. So I would argue that, in fact, it's thanks to Mary, not in spite of Mary, that he became a great essayist.
Let's talk, or I would ask you to talk, about what life would have been like in the Lamb household in 1796 before the murder occurred.
Certainly. The Lamb family lived all of Charles and Mary's childhood in what's called the Inner Temple in London. The Inner Temple still exists today. It is one of the inns of court in the old part of the city of London, but actually it's outside the city of London because the Inner Temple was itself a kind of sanctuary, walled in, a kind of a campus where barristers and barristers in training would live together, they would dine together, they would study together, and in fact even the barristers who would go to practice law lived in the Inner Temple. It was one of those people, a somewhat high-ranking member of the Inner Temple, for whom John and Elizabeth, the parents of Mary and Charles Lamb, worked. John Lamb was both head waiter at the Inner Temple and also attendant to the barrister named Samuel Salt. And this gave him and his family quarters in the Inner Temple, a very prestigious location to live in London, and yet they were living the servant's life. It would have been an odd mix of being of the serving class and yet in an elegant and somewhat sort of isolated, pristine setting, even in the midst of the of London of the late 18th century, which was rather scruffy and dirty. Not far from the Inner Temple would have been the jails, Bridewell Prison, all kinds of down and dirty scenes, but inside the walls of the Inner Temple it was very quiet and elegant and safe. And that was the setting that Charles and Mary grew up in. Unfortunately, in 1792, Samuel Salt died, which meant that the Lamb family no longer had the privilege of living inside the Inner Temple. And so they moved just a few blocks outside, but into the City of London, still in the legal district, but in a flat. At that point, the household was five in number. The older brother had already moved out, but the two children who were at that time in 1796, the time of the murder, Charles was 21 years old and Mary was 31 years old. There were three elders in the family. There was John Lamb, the father, who actually soon after the death of Samuel Salt appears to have had a stroke. And out of charity, he was kept on the roll and the payroll of the Inner Temple, but he really couldn't work there any longer. So he got a tiny stipend still from the Inner Temple. There was Elizabeth Lamb, who perhaps in a kind of a sympathy or almost attention-getting way, but perhaps honestly and physically, became paralyzed in these years, after the death of Samuel Salt. And there was an even older aunt, the sister of Mary's father, who had never gotten along with her sister-in-law. So it's a difficult household situation. Tiny flat, three needy elders, a 21-year-old man who's stepping out on his own with a new job at the East India Company, and a 31-year-old young woman who is left behind to take care of household, cooking, three elders, two of whom are physically debilitated, and on top of that, take in sewing to make some money. Hmm. That's the scene of Mary Lamb's life in the days coming up to the day that she murdered her mother.
And apparently right before that, she was persuaded to take in a little girl.
That's right.
As to be both an apprentice to learn what Mary know of the needle trade, and then also to help out with chores around the house. And it sounds like this little girl was about next to useless,
right,
because she didn't really know how to do anything. So here's Mary in this small space trying to care for three elderly relatives with this little girl underfoot, having to do all the work, and perhaps feeling, understandably feeling trapped in this situation, maybe feeling that there was no life for her other than that life of having to provide care for all of these people. And it seems that she just snapped on this day in 1796.
That's the way, you know, and listening to you say all that, it makes me need to say that so much of that particular part of the scenario can only be come to by surmise. We don't have Mary's description. We have Charles's description of a day or two later of what happened, but it all fits together. I mean, there was an apprentice, a nine-year-old girl, probably from a very poor family, who had apprenticed her out because that's the only way they could support her. She came into the household about 3 days before the matricide occurred. I just assume that a nine-year-old girl, all of a sudden, out of her household and into someone else's, would be terrified and useless, frankly. I mean, sweet as can be, but not for a 31-year-old woman who already has three or maybe even four dependents. Not for her to take on. It would not be help. It would be a burden. And it just seems logical that that might have been the straw that broke the camel's back. It is also important to mention that there appears to have been a kind of strain of mental illness in the family. Charles himself actually had already spent 6 weeks in Hoxton House, one of the most famous private madhouses of London, just the winter before. There are some rumors that other members or older members of the family had mental illness. I think perhaps the mother did as well, because she seems to have been somewhat difficult on her daughter. And Mary, too, had already, we don't know very much about it, but she had already had one lapse into some sort of mental illness. It sounds like it was a depression. It sounds like she actually went to bed and couldn't get up for quite a while, and perhaps was given the current day antidote for that kind of situation, which would have been an opiate derivative, laudanum. All of that had happened beforehand, so it gives you grounds to say that probably she had a mental breakdown of some sort. I suggest it might be a bipolar breakdown, but a function of a bipolar disease. But there's no way that you can really psychoanalyze people 200 years ago.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Susan Tyler Hitchcock. She's written 11 books, has contributed to newspapers, magazines, essay anthologies. The book that we're talking about this morning is titled Mad Mary Lamb, Lunacy and Murder in Literary London. It's published by W.W. Norton and is out just recently. It was published in late part of January, and certainly you could find it in the bookstore if you're interested in looking at it. And, of course, questions are welcome here on the program this morning, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Certainly, I think we would have expected that a sensational event like this now and as well as then would have gotten publicity. How much publicity was there?
Well, it appears that maybe four of the London newspapers, and there would have been many more newspapers in London at the time, ran some kind of little notice. One of them, I have one, and let me just read you the beginning of it. This would have appeared, the murder was on a Thursday, and the first newspaper account that I found was on a Monday, down at the bottom corner of an inside page of the paper, with no headline, saying, on Friday afternoon, the coroner and a jury sat on the body of a lady in the neighborhood of Holborn who died in consequence of a wound from her daughter the preceding day. And it ends, as all of the newspaper reports end, the jury, of course, brought in their verdict, lunacy. All of the newspaper, these few, but all of the newspaper accounts are so similar word for word that I'm quite sure that they all took language from this coroner's report. In London at that time, if there was an unnatural death, what would have happened would be that the coroner, who was sort of like a sheriff for that district of London, would gather together a small group of worthy citizens who would come as a coroner's jury and, as this article says, sit on the bottom, that is, examine the body of the dead, and determine what they could of what happened. And that did happen then the day after the murder. What had happened in the meantime, though, was that Charles Lamb had taken his sister Mary to a private madhouse, not big Hoxton House that he had been in 6 months before, but a smaller one in the village of Islington, which would have then been country. Now it's actually part of the larger metropolitan area of London. But he had probably Thursday evening had her admitted to a private madhouse, so that when the coroner arrived, the plot was already in a sense laid to express this as an act of lunacy, and that was in fact what the coroner's jury determined.
Well, as you say, there was this coroner's inquest, and certainly what had happened, it's not known precisely what had happened and what were the precipitating events, but what had happened, in a sense, was clear that Mary had killed her mother.
Right.
And so there was no doubt about that.
There was no doubt. And in fact, you know, the aunt was probably cogent enough to be a witness. The apprentice girl certainly was a witness. Their landlord came up and walked in on the deed. And Charles arrived actually just minutes after it had happened. So all of these newspaper articles actually are the main source for the dramatic details of the act. And I take it that someone, probably Charles, had given the coroner's jury some details, but I think they may have taken a little bit of fictional license and made it more dramatic than the family account.
Well, the inquest concluded that, as you say, that this was an act of lunacy, and that was a term of law of the time. What exactly did that mean?
Right. In the English courts, and I suspect this continues to the present day, there was a distinction between idiocy and lunacy. Idiocy was a state of mental imbalance from which one never had and never would escape. That is, someone who was out of her or his mind all their life. Lunacy, on the other hand, coming from the word luna for moon, was a way to describe a person who was in and out of mental instability. That is, there were times of rationality and sensibleness, and then there were periods or spells or breakthroughs of irrationality, and that was the description of how they saw Mary Lamb, that she had been, and this even was put in the newspaper. She had, in the longest account from one newspaper, she had in fact been a good and dutiful daughter, but that this was a momentary break out of that behavior that could only be described as lunatic in their terms.
So Charles, clearly right at the beginning there, he took his sister out of the house, placed her in this private institution, and clearly the coroner ruled that that she had done it, but that she was considered to be, quote, a lunatic, that is, someone who was rational, sometimes irrational at others. I guess to us now it might seem a little bit surprising, though, that that the coroner would look at Charles' decision to place his sister in this private madhouse, and apparently that was that. There was no trial. She wasn't charged with a crime. They apparently thought that he had everything under control, and that was the end of it.
That's right. And that's the way it was in the English legal system at that time. There really was nothing like what we today call the insanity plea. In the courts, that would have started not until the 1840s, 1843 to be exact, with a very specific case, the McNaughton case, in which a man attempting to kill the prime minister actually did kill his attendant, and his defense was argued on the basis of physicians' examinations of him and his mental state. That really was a watershed in English and thus American law, but before 1840, things were a lot looser. There was a general sympathy toward people who conducted acts of violence out of a crazed state, although there certainly are cases both before and after Mary Lamb in which family murders, whether we're talking about murder of a parent, murder of a child, murder of a spouse, got just excruciating punishment, I mean, including excruciating forms of death. And in this case, somehow, Mary Lamb was viewed sympathetically, and Charles probably did a very good job of presenting himself and affirming not only when the coroner visited, but then 6 months later when Mary Lamb was released from that madhouse, affirming to the authorities that he was going to be her guardian and that he would protect her and also protect his community from her if that needed to happen.
What can be said about how Charles felt about what his sister had done?
That's an interesting question. Charles wrote a number of letters to his best friend, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, in the days, weeks, and even months after the murder, in which we really get a clearer glimpse of Charles's psyche than we do of Mary's at that time. There was sorrow, indeed, although it was measured sorrow. And, in fact, there's one letter when he tells Coleridge that it's only on a Saturday, or maybe it was Sunday night, a night when they had a group of friends in as sort of a memorial service. That was the first time he cried. He is greatly a champion of his sister from the very beginning. And there is a very revealing letter in this time frame of the first week or two after the murder in which he tells Coleridge that his mother had always favored their older brother and had really responded coldly and judgmentally to her daughter, despite the fact that Mary was the one who had given the most to her in her lifetime and served her the most. So you get the sense, I mean, this is very difficult to say because it sounds so horrible, but you do get the sense that Charles, to some extent, understood Mary's impulse. And Mary herself, this is in a, Mary wrote Charles a letter from the madhouse, and Charles, it never was found, but Charles rephrased it. And Charles reports that a week into his time in the madhouse, Mary says, "I believe that my mother is looking down from heaven at me and understands me." So there was a sense between these two children that it was as it should be. Maybe there was an element of putting her mother out of her misery, because she certainly was ailing. She was paralyzed. She needed Mary to help her move from place to place. She had Mary living in the bed, sleeping in the bed with her, and to have help in the middle of the night. And there may have been a little bit of mercy involved in this killing, but I also think that Charles understood Mary's frustration as well.
And Mary apparently, for her part, never said in so many words that she regretted what she had done.
She never did. And I have talked to some people, both legal and psychiatric, who say that that proves that Mary was beyond a knowledge of right and wrong, and that in the, you know, the current insanity plea, that would show her to, you know, to really be insane. That is, she had no sense of right or wrong, no sense that she had done wrong. But I don't quite read it that way. I think she recognized the wrong. I think she grappled with it all her life. She, from that point on in her life, she had about 10 or 20 years of productivity and good, lively adult life. But from about 1815 on, she began to decline to the point that she had more periods of retreat and depression than she had living productive, you know, lively productive times. And I think that the crime really ended up being a burden that pulled her down beyond being an active adult. But for the remarkably, for the 20 years after the murder, she did cycle through occasional manic periods when she would say, "It's time to go to the madhouse," and Charles and she would walk solemnly, and she would really sort of sign herself in a way for a couple of weeks, a couple of months at a time. But through those 20 productive years, there were only there were fewer than one time in the madhouse per 2 years. So there were plenty of days and months when she was living a good life and not only writing with her brother, but providing this household setting for a wonderful circle of literary friends, artistic friends, who would come weekly and eat and drink and talk art and culture.
Mm. At the time in England, there were a couple of public hospitals for people who were mentally ill, and the most famous of which would be Bedlam, from which we get the expression. There also were private institutions, and if you had the money, you could go, or a family member could go to one of these places, like Fisher House, where Charles took Mary.
Right.
What was what sort of treatment was there available at the time for people who were mentally ill?
Well, it's quite remarkable, to some degree horrifying. There's been an enormous amount of study and description of these madhouses, both public and private. It's a fascinating time of in the history of mental health treatment. It's kind of a turning point. Looking back in time from 1796, there would have been remarkably physical, and we would call them cruel, absolutely cruel and inhumane ways of treating the mentally ill. I mean, historically, the mentally ill and the poor were lumped together in English law, and the mentally ill in particular were treated physically with the thought that the problem was something in the body. It was maybe it was an imbalance of fluids, because they had this whole theory of the humors, the theory of the fluids that energized or debilitated a person. And the theory would have been that the fluids were out of balance in a person who was crazy, was a lunatic. And they needed to be brought back into balance. So people would be... There would be bloodletting, there would be leeching, there would be a cupping, which is a way of putting a heated glass cup excuse me, on the body to make a kind of a welt. There would be dunking, which would be fast dipping, kind of putting a person on a chair strapped to a wheel and dunking them into cold water, or pouring cold water on top of them. Laudanum, as I mentioned, began to be used more and more, but other herbal and mineral remedies, some of which now we look back and we realize they actually would have been harmful to the people. And oftentimes people who were physically demonstrative, that is, they would thrash or hit, and in fact we know that Mary did thrash at sometimes in her manic periods, they would have actually been chained to the wall, chained to the floor, chained to their beds, put in straitjackets, which would have been the more humane treatment. Now, I said, though, that this was a turning point, because at about this time, in the late 1800s, there were new ways of treating the mentally ill, a kind of more humane, more compassionate, and in their terms, they called it a more moral treatment of the mentally ill. This had to do more with engaging the personality, engaging the person in spirit and mind, looking straight in the eyes of the person, talking with the person. One very famous historian of the times named Roy Porter actually says that this was the period of time when psychiatry as we know it today began. And it seems to me, as I'm looking at the Lamb family history, that Charles had reason to be aware of this, and also to have a number of friends who were in the dissenting community. That is the community of religious groups like the Unitarians and the Quakers. The Quakers were the leaders in this moral treatment of the mentally ill. And I believe that through his friends and his knowledge of the possibilities, Charles Lamb from the very beginning sought out humane and calm, peaceful, and loving madhouses as far as he could go, and avoided the ones that had the older, more physical and more cruel treatments as their main way of dealing with their patients.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Susan Tyler Hitchcock. And if you're interested in reading this story, you should go out to the bookstore and look for the book Mad Mary Lamb, Lunacy and Murder in Literary London. It's published by W.W. Norton. Our guest has written 11 books and has also contributed to magazines, newspapers, essay anthologies. She has a B.A. and M.A. in English from University of Michigan, Ph.D. in English from University of Virginia, and for much of her career has worked in the publishing world. She's currently a contract book editor for the National Geographic Society. And again, questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL, or 9455. As you explained, after the murder, Charles had his sister, put his sister in this private madhouse, this private institution. She was there for 6 months. He then moved her to her own room, a room of her own. She lived on her own there until their father died, and then she came home. And that was really the beginning of their life together. They lived together. Neither of them married. They were together for almost 40 years and lived this life where during the daytime she would basically take care of the household. Initially, I guess, doing all the work. Later, when they had enough money, they had a servant. But right. That was sort of her sphere during the daytime. He went off to work. He was a clerk at the East India Company. But then at night, they would invite friends over, and they had a salon. They would talk about literature and the arts, and they'd eat and drink and have a great time.
Right.
How did people regard this arrangement of theirs, the fact that that the two of them were living together? Not suggesting anything improper about it, but that, and essentially that was, they were a family, the two of them. They lived together and had this sort of odd life where they got through life in the daytime, and the real part of the exciting part of their life and their writing work was the evenings and other times. How did people think about them?
Well, Charles called it in one famous passage that they lived a life of double singleness. I don't think that in those days they would have had to add that comment that you make about nothing was wrong with it, because I think that families lived together, many generation families lived together. There wasn't as much money or space. It really would have been more common. I mean, Dorothy and William Wordsworth were also a famous brother and sister pair. It's interesting, though, that the image of a brother and sister in the romantic tradition, in the tradition of the poets, Shelley, Byron, there are all sorts of interesting implications to the brother-sister pair. I mean, Shelley took it to an extreme of writing poems in which he said that essentially the woman he was looking for would be even closer than a sister. She would be kind of a sister of his soul. Byron, of course, is known to have had a sexual relationship with his half-sister. So there in the wind, there certainly were implications. I don't think anyone saw that or thought that. I have to tell you that in trying to make this a book that would sell well, I looked everywhere for sex, and I couldn't find any. So I was really ready to find it, and I just couldn't. I think that that Mary was a counterpoint to her brother in their circle of friends, in the sense that Charles was He was extremely sarcastic. He would always make fun of people. He would make fun of himself as well, which sort of wins him over. He doesn't end up being totally supercilious. He makes as much fun or more of himself than of other people. But Mary, on the other hand, would have been a listener, a kind of support person. One of their friends, William Hazlitt, wrote that it was Mary who helped him feel comfortable in the midst of all those, poetic giants. So I think the two of them were a great team among their close circle of friends. From the outside, again, I don't think it would have looked unusual. Although I will say that there was a point, just a few months really after Mary had moved back in. Both the aunt and the father died within the year and a half after Mary's act of matricide and her going into the madhouse, so that when that had happened and when they had died, when Charles was then alone, he was able to move Mary back to the apartment where he had lived with his father for a little while. And just months after that, he moved again. and he wrote a letter to Coleridge saying, the phrase was, "We are in a manner marked." In other words, I'm afraid our neighbors know that she's crazy, there's something funny going on, and we got to get back basically into the middle of the city where they aren't going to be watching so closely. Mm. So there are hints of a feeling in him that, you know, there may be some public displeasure or judgment against them, but once that's one of the reasons, actually, they lived their whole life in the city. Even though their friends, Wordsworth and Coleridge, were the poets famous for, you know, odes to nature and addresses in the you know, to the majesty of the universe and all that, Charles and Mary wanted to be right there in the middle of the city of London.
Because it conferred some anonymity?
Pardon?
Because it conferred anonymity, or because they just liked city life?
Both, I think. They loved the theater. There's a really famous letter from, or funny letter from Charles. They take a week-long summer vacation on the Isle of Wight, and Charles wrote back to one of his friends saying, "I just miss the grit and the dirt and the rats." So I think they genuinely liked city life, as well as feeling that they could live their lives without being spied upon.
Well, we have a caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation. Someone listening here in Urbana, where we are, line number one.
Morning. This is a terribly interesting program, and I'm sure the book is very interesting also. I'm wondering about the actual writing. Did each of them write separately, or did one write and then the other edit, or what was their relationship in terms of their writing?
That's a very interesting question, and it's one that I did think a lot about and wrote about in the book. There are some records, mostly, you know, letters from Charles or that kind of thing, where he says, for example, in Tales from Shakespeare, he clearly says that although Mary was given the assignment, as it turned out, she wrote the comedies and he wrote the tragedies. But I believe that, in fact, there was an intimate collaboration going on all the way along. Because sometimes Mary will write a letter to a friend saying, Charles is in a slump, he's just not doing too well with Macbeth, I'm having to help him. Or Charles would say, Mary's just, you know, stuck on All's Well That Ends Well, and, you know, we've been talking about it. I'm paraphrasing here, but you get the sense, even in Tales from Shakespeare, that they helped each other, because there is a sort of uniformity of voice. The other two books that they wrote together are interesting in that way, too. They wrote what I think is really the best and probably the closest to Mary Lamb's own book, a book of short stories called Mrs. Lester's School. Now, again, we've been told by letters from Charles exactly which ones he wrote and which ones Mary wrote. In this case, I think it might be closer to true, because the style of writing in those designated by Mary is sweet, simple, direct, and almost as if she is writing at the level that she knows her readers can manage, which would be about young adolescent girls. Charles, on the other hand, whose writing style, if you know his essays, is very convoluted and dependent clause upon dependent clause and very ornate and somewhat sarcastic a lot. You see little glimpses of that in the few stories of Mrs. Lester's School that that are said to have been by him. So I think there may have been a little bit less of passing the paper back and forth. But the third book is called Poetry for Children, and again, although we never got the list that's Charles actually marked the table of contents up for a friend in a volume he sent, saying, "These are mine, these are hers." And of course, he said, "Of course, mine are the best." But in that volume, there is a poem in which there's a brother. Often, many of the poems have to do with brothers and sisters, and some of them are dialogues, like the brother says a stanza, then the sister says a stanza. One of those is about sort of like if you've ever played a game called Round Robin,
yes,
where you write a line and then you pass it
right
to the next,
right,
it's just like that.
Uh-huh.
So the brother writes one stanza, hands it to the sister, she writes another stanza back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a clue to us that a lot of that kind of writing went on between the two of them.
So they were very collaborative.
I'm absolutely sure.
And the last word of Mrs. Lester's is Mrs. Lester's
cool
world.
School.
Oh,
it's
school.
A school.
I'm sorry.
It's actually a finishing school for young girls, and my theory is it's the school that Mary wishes she could have gone to.
Uh-huh.
And it's the plan of the book is that the schoolmistress gathers up the new girls in front of the fire, and each of the girls is to tell a story, true or not, that will let the others get to know her.
Oh, what a wonderful... I must get that book. Well,
well
thank you so
much.
It's
hard to find, but good luck.
I will continue
all right
to listen.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Back when we started to the conversation, and you talked first about Tales from Shakespeare, which is, probably the thing that the Lambs are, for most people, will be most known for.
Yes.
When the book was first published... her name was not on it. Was her name on the other books that they wrote together?
No. As a matter of fact, what happened was Mrs. Lester's Tales from Shakespeare was published by Charles Lamb. Mrs. Lester's School was published without an author named. And Poetry for Children was published by the author of Mrs. Lester's School. So it's all kept secret that she had anything to do with the writing of any three of these books.
How is it that it was writing for children that they became involved in?
Well, that question brings in another major character in the story, who is William Godwin. William Godwin is not much known today. Perhaps he would be best known if I said that he was the husband of Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, and is considered really the first feminist tract ever written in history. But Godwin himself, in his heyday, was a political hero. He wrote a massive volume called An Enquiry Concerning Political Justice, which, believe it or not, this was like a 700-page book, but believe it or not, labor unions in the north of England would buy one copy, and they would have union meetings and read it aloud to their union members. It was so important to the working classes of England. Unfortunately, Godwin and a number of his other people, other friends and colleagues who were very active and vocal about the underling and the poor. In fact, they were hoping that England would have a revolution in the same lines that they saw France having. Because the French Revolution went sour, and also because France was threatening all through this period to attack England, people like Godwin, who had once championed the revolutionaries in France, were considered enemies of the state. And although Godwin was himself not arrested or tried, many of his friends were. And so he had to figure out a way to express his political beliefs more quietly. And the way he did it was to begin publishing children's books. He had known Charles Lamb to some extent through friends, through this literary circle, but really came to him, first of all, to ask him to do The King and Queen of Tarts, a small, it was almost like a comic book. It was a redo of this, the famous the King of Hearts, the Queen of Hearts, she had some tarts, or baked some tarts, the children's rhyme that we all know. But it went on through about 12 verses, all of which Charles wrote, and ended up, it was illustrated in the Godwin edition, but it ended up with the queen and king getting tipsy, as royalty is wont to do. And I think that was going a little over the line for Godwin. So when he came up with another children's book project, he went to Charles's sister instead of Charles himself, and got a little bit more proper product out of the deal.
We are getting very short on time. I want to try to include one more caller that we have here, someone listening in Champaign, so we'll go there. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, I was just curious, about your studies on bipolarism or about mental illness and things like that in literary talent or poetic talent.
Yes.
And You just mentioned, for example, that Charles Lamb piled one dependent clause upon another dependent clause. I mean, did you ever look at the issues of things of that nature, bipolarism and syntax and things like that?
I think that that would be a really fruitful line of study. I chose not to do it partly because of my concern over this issue of psychoanalyzing the past, and partly because it was a direction I didn't want to become expert in myself. I was more interested in the history and literature. But where I found my information, I did talk to psychiatrists, I did do some reading, and the most important book that I found, which I refer to in my book and found to be sort of a light came on when I read it, is a book called The Fire Within.
Yes, that was what I was thinking of.
Exactly. Manic Depressive Disorder and the Creative Imagination. It's by a psychiatrist named Kay Redfield Jamison, who's also written a number of books, including a memoir of her own as a sufferer of bipolar disorder. And that book, The Fire Within, really describes the symptoms of bipolar disorder as they often can lead to bursts of creativity. And at the end of the book, she actually has a list of authors, composers, poets, artists, all of whom she suspects may have had bysmal disorder. Percy Bysshe Shelley, Mary Shelley, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Charles Lamb, all are on that list. And I actually believe that Mary Lamb belongs on that list as well.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies to the caller, but we're simply going to have to stop because we've used our time. There is more than we have discussed in this book. So if you're interested in reading more, you should go out and look for it. The book we're talking about is Mad Mary Lamb, Lunacy and Murder in Literary London. It's published by W.W. Norton by our guest Susan Tyler Hitchcock. And if you're interested in finding out more about her and some of her other work, she does have her own website, which is SusanTylerHitchcock.com, and you can check that out. And Ms. Hitchcock, we want to say to you, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure. I love to talk about this.
Very good. Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Programs also made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. On the next Afternoon Magazine today, we'll look back at the covert wars in Afghanistan that helped fuel Islamic militancy. Celeste Quinn talks with Steve Call about his book Ghost Wars. It's a history of the CIA in Afghanistan and has just won the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction. You can hear the conversation at 1 o'clock. The show itself gets underway at noon with news, weather, sports, other things. Celeste Quinn is the host. In our next hour, we'll be talking about Togo and the crisis that occurred there just a couple of months ago, what it means for democracy in Africa. We'll be talking with Charles Pio. He's an anthropologist from Duke University. Right now, though, we'll break. We'll have news from National Public Radio. Before that, an update on the markets.